It's 7:43. I'm Teresa Wills. On this West Virginia morning, we explore the traditional craft of basket making.
One day, my mom said, you need to start making baskets, because if you don't start making and learning how to weave baskets, it's going to die out.
And we meet the District 1 candidates running for seats on the West Virginia Supreme Court. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. West Virginians join those across the country rallying to oppose police violence against Black people. Emily Allen reports.
Protesters marched in Huntington, Morgantown, and Parkersburg, among other locations this weekend, in solidarity with thousands of Americans who have taken to the streets protesting the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis and Breonna Taylor in Louisville at the hands of police. In Charleston, more than 100 West Virginia protesters gathered outside City Hall and the police department Sunday. A separate virtual rally between Black leaders and advocates from all over the state allowed for more social distancing. Here's Jerry Carr of the Morgantown NAACP.
When you remember, when we're trying to go through this process of remembrance, remember the victims, but remember the people who are still here and the type of things that we want to push forward.
As of Sunday evening, reports indicated most demonstrations in the Mountain State were peaceful. But protest organizers say they have and continue to receive some outside threats of violence. More West Virginia events are slated to continue this week. In Charleston, protesters will be at the state capitol on Sunday, June 7th. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Emily Allen.
West Virginia Public Broadcasting is in the process of obtaining information on gunfire during a protest in Martinsburg Sunday night. Watch our website, wvpublic.org, for more. The June 9 primary will decide three seats on the bench of the state's highest court. 11 candidates across three divisions are vying for the open spots on West Virginia's Supreme Court of Appeals. The election decides two 12-year terms and the four remaining years left on the other term. Voters' choices will have a significant impact on the state's legal realm for some time. So we're taking a look at those races over the next few days. Dave Mistich begins this series by introducing voters to the three candidates from Division One.
Chief Justice Tim Armstead was appointed to the West Virginia Supreme Court in August 2018 by Governor Jim Justice. That was following the resignation of justices who were involved in a scandal related to lavish spending on office renovations and other misappropriation of state funds. Armstead went on to win and keep the seat after a special election that November. Armstead, who is a former speaker of the West Virginia House of Delegates, says he feels the court has come a long way since that scandal in 2018.
I think we've made tremendous progress, as I mentioned, in putting in place the types of guidelines and expectations from an ethical standpoint that are necessary not only for the Supreme Court, but throughout our court system. And I think we need to, first of all, make sure we follow those and that we have the right checks and balances in place to make sure they're being followed. And I think we've done that.
Some candidates in the race for Division One say right now that the state Supreme Court takes too long to resolve cases, but Armstead disagrees.
I think we're very much consistent with our Constitution, which says that the court should look at cases and decide cases, and that they can decide a case whenever they believe there's a proper point for consideration. And so I disagree that we're behind. I think we're getting our work done efficiently.
Former Justice Richard Neely has already once served on the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals from 1973 to 1995 and has also served as Chief Justice. He says court reforms are not a concern for most residents of the state.
The average person doesn't give a damn about things like accountability, transparency. They don't even know what the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals is. They have absolutely no idea how the court system is administered, unless they're lawyers or people who are involved somehow in the government. What they want is good results. They want a system that gives them speed, a just decision in a reasonable period of time.
Now in a bid for a second stint on the bench, Neely is concerned about the rising number of abuse and neglect cases in the state, and he says the Supreme Court has become inefficient over the last decade.
The court is indeed suffering an inordinate delay, and that's because they do not follow Article 8, Section 4 of the Constitution. Our Constitution lays out a very good, expeditious way of handling appeals. It worked very well for 150 years. The court, for some strange reason back in 2010, decided to mess with it and change it.
Judge David Hummel Jr. is another candidate trying to unseat Armstead in Division I. Hummel oversees cases in West Virginia's Second Circuit, which covers Marshall, Tyler, and Wetzel counties.
And I've served now 12 years in the trenches as a circuit court judge, and I know what happens in a courtroom. I also serve as a treatment court judge, and I have for 12 years as well. Drug court, mental health court, which combined them for treatment court. And the experience I've gained through that, I believe, is invaluable and something our state needs to further advance its attack, its defenses against mental health and drug addiction issues.
Hummel says he respects the careers of both Armstead and Neely, but says experience as a circuit court judge is key to positively impacting the state's court system.
Even the manager at McDonald's knows how to cook the fries. So I think it's a ground-up approach to being a Supreme Court justice is the time and energy I've put in being a circuit judge, making those decisions that affect lives. I boiled down being a circuit judge to the basic thing, and one of the things is, I decide where people sleep, whether it's in prison, in jail, whether they see their children or not again. These are heavy decisions that I'm experienced and have been making for the last 12 years.
The Republican State Leadership Committee's Judicial Fairness Initiative has spent more than $300,000 in support of Armstead. The group has also spent more than $600,000 to oppose Neely. Restart West Virginia, another independent expenditure who is attempting to influence the Supreme Court elections, has spent more than $220,000 opposing Armstead and more than $190,000 supporting Neely. Neither group spent money supporting or opposing Hummel in Division I. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Dave Mistich.
To learn more about candidates for the West Virginia Supreme Court, tune in Thursday, June 4th at 6 p.m. for a two-hour candidate forum that includes 10 of 11 jurists running across the three divisions. That program airs on the West Virginia Public Broadcasting television stations and will also be available online at wvpublic.org. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:51. Some areas of fog this morning, becoming mostly sunny today, highs in the 70s. Increasing clouds overnight, lows in the 50s. Cloudy tomorrow in the eastern panhandle, becoming mostly sunny elsewhere, highs in the 70s and low 80s. Support for WVPB is provided by HQ Publishing Company, publisher of Huntington Quarterly, Marshall Magazine, and other publications since 1989. HQPublishing.com. The Eastern Band of Cherokee have been making baskets for centuries. Theirs may be an old art form, but basket makers have adapted to a lot of changes over the years, and their traditions have too. From imagining new designs to dealing with hard-to-come-by materials. Basket makers are a resilient group dedicated to keeping their craft alive. Inside Appalachia Folkways reporter Rachel Green spoke to two women in Cherokee, North Carolina, doing just that.
Some artists hone their skills in classrooms. Others, like Betty Maney, are practically born into their art.
When you live in something, you just know the process.
Betty is a small woman with a kind, round face and short gray hair. She's a renowned weaver of white oak and river cane baskets and a member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee. Like many other Cherokee basket makers, she learned her art by watching her mother, shadowing her as she gathered materials.
When Mom went out to cut her tree down, we went with her. You know, we were with her in everything that she did.
Betty and her siblings were also there when their mom cut the tree into splints. Betty remembers her mom would lay a scrap of blue jean fabric on her lap and whittle the splints down until they were smooth and ready to be dyed and woven. Betty, who works out of her home studio in Cherokee, North Carolina, started making baskets in the mid-1990s. Her mom, Geraldine Walkingstick, was a well-known basket maker. She encouraged Betty to pick up basketry, too.
One day, my mom said, you need to start making baskets, because if you don't start making and learning how to weave baskets, it's going to die out.
Weaving also allowed Betty to make extra money for her family. She got her start with white oak, her mom's signature material, and she was a natural.
Looking back, I realized that it's amazing how I already knew. Mom didn't have to sit down and say, okay, this is how you lay your splints out, and this is how you have to go over and under one.
During the 1930s, ethnographers identified nearly two dozen basket patterns traditionally woven by the Eastern Band of Cherokee. The patterns are geometrical and can be somewhat abstract. The flowing water pattern, for example, is made of intersecting splints that zigzag up the side of a basket. Many are dyed with plants like walnut or butternut bark to create color contrast.
Here's some of the butternut.
Betty relies on that contrast to create her distinct and precise patterns.
And this is the spiral lid that I'm using to make the lid for this one.
She likes symmetry and uses different colored splints to repeat certain elements like vertical lines or bands that encircle the basket.
What I like to do is do a band around the bottom. And as I weave up, I put a separation in there by repeating a specific design with some colors.
They're usually oval or vase-shaped, sometimes with lids, sometimes with handles. It's all up to the basket maker.
And then I will repeat the bottom design on the top, so it's real distinctive when you look at it.
And for Betty, the patterns are a continuation of her mother's legacy.
My mom's designs that she used in her basket still live through me and my sister. To us, that's keeping her work alive.
But Betty finds ways to put her own spin on what she learned from her mom, too.
I call what I do contemporary cultural art, because it's always an improvement. You're always coming up with something different. You're always making things your own.
You can't make these baskets just anywhere. Many of the materials used, like river cane or bloodroot, are native to the southeastern United States.
It's just something that's important to the Cherokee, to our culture, because it identifies who we are, what we do, and why it's important to us. That was our way of life. That's how we survived.
Betty started making baskets during a craft revival in the 1990s. By then, baskets were mostly sold in craft stores to tourists or entered in competitions. In the past, though, Betty says they were mostly utilitarian.
When I was little, we still needed them for fish baskets, and the small square ones were used as a sieve in the hominy-making process to rinse the ash out of the hominy. And then the handle baskets were used for gathering and storage.
The tourism industry started growing in Cherokee after the nearby Blue Ridge Parkway was completed in 1936. Although baskets were still used in everyday life, basket makers also began selling them to tourists during the busy summer months. Basket making plays an important role in Cherokee's economy, but pressure from tourism and increased land development made it more difficult to find basket making materials in the wild.
The resources, the natural resources, became scarce. And that was largely due to private landowners and development. Like the river cane that grows along the cornfields, farmers were just plowing it up and burning it.
And Betty isn't the only artist to feel the effects of this scarcity. Faye Junaluska is a basket maker with 40 years experience who has also had trouble sourcing her materials. Faye comes from a long line of basket makers.
There's my great-grandma, my grandma, my mother, and me, so I'm a fourth generation myself.
Like Betty, she learned the art from her mother, Emma Squirrel Taylor, whose work was even displayed in the Smithsonian Museum of American History. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Rachel Green in Cherokee, North Carolina.
That excerpt was from a story that's part of the Inside Appalachia Folkways Reporting Project. Hear the rest of this story on the latest episode of Inside Appalachia this Sunday morning at 7 or Sunday evening at 6. You can find more stories of Appalachian folk life, arts, and culture by subscribing to the podcast. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Brittany Patterson produces our show. Our news director is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.